Well, that was the first debugging. They call that debugging the computer. That was the first instance when they used the term debugging.
Another
From
debugging the program, I guess they say it.
that's right. But this one was debugging the computer.
And who did it? Some housewife?
No, this was in the MIT. MIT, their first computer. They one of the first. Computer, one button computer. I'm off. It entered the computer wires and died there, and he was causing a short circuit between the wires. So the capacity or something had changed of the wires, and therefore was giving a wrong calculation. Until they cleaned out that bug, they couldn't get the thing to work properly. So.
Anyone else,
Strange.
Prabhuji? Prabhuji, anyone else to be added?
You see, Krishna Prabhu.
99. All right, so we're on page 99 of Subjective Evolution, Thesis, Antithesis, Synthesis. Namo Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Prastaya Bhutale, Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Dinamine. Namaste Sarasati Deve. Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschichade Satavine Om Aginati Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yenina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Tadati Svapadantikam Panjakalpataru Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyavacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Hare Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare
Hare
Hey Rama,
Hare
Rama, Rama, Hare, Hare. Excuse me. Now, thesis and this is synthesis. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj, what subjects are you studying? Student, philosophy and religion. Srila Maharaj, at which university? Srila Maharaj, you are a student of religion and philosophy. Have you studied Hegel? Hegel's philosophy is sometimes described as panentheism. Panentheism proposes that God is present in all things. But in contrast to pantheism, it affirms that God is also an independent being above and beyond all things. Hegel is also known for perfectionism. He says that the nature of the absolute is both conditioned and unconditioned combined. Truth develops thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, and by this method everything progresses. According to Hegel, the absolute is by itself and for itself, and he also used the German equivalent of the expression die to live. These were his chosen expressions. Such expressions are very useful for those in the theistic line. If you want to live a progressive life, you will have to die as you are. Your ego must be dissolved, and then the real inner or finer self come out. This is a good philosophy to have appeared amongst the Westerners. The concept of die to live comes in the line of Vaishnavism. Hegel also said that the absolute is by himself and for himself. For himself means that the absolute truth is a supreme enjoyer. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Aham hi sarva yogyanam, bhokta cha pravareva cha, na tu mam abhijananti, tatfenatas chavantite." This is the most vital point to establish God as a person. He is the enjoyer. If anything is enjoyed, the enjoyer of the supreme position. this cannot but be. Everything is meant for his enjoyment, and he is the supreme. By himself means that the absolute is supreme. Everything is meant for his satisfaction. This is a necessary truth. It is not questionable, and also his existence is subjective. No object can exist without a subject. No thing can exist without a thinker. There must be a thinker. For example, what is a fossil? As we examine it, we observe color and hardness of the stone, but these qualities are simply thoughts within us, a thinking stage. Let me just make some comment here. Srila Mars is saying, no object can exist without a subject. No thing can exist without a thinker. In English, the word thing and the word think are very similar. They differ by only one letter. Think and thing differ by only one letter from each other. So no thing can exist without a thinker. It shows that in English, the relationship between these two words, the close relationship between thing and think, are given in their explicit form from the very words themselves. We can see there's a tight relationship, thing and think. So this inability for a thing to exist without thinking is related to this idea that object cannot exist without a subject. Because when you think of it, what is an object? In the Greek, object, J-E-C-T, that word, object, comes from the same thing like a projectile. When you talk about project something, or a projectile, that's something that is thrown. So object means which is opposed, a thrown against something. Then the very word object means that is thrown against. Be thrown, then what is it thrown against? Okay, so that which is thrown against is the subject. And to subject also means to throw under. To be a subject means to throw something under it. To be thrown under. Either to throw something under or to be thrown under. So in both ways, the subject means who is throwing under itself the object. What is object to it is thrown under it. It throws it under itself. It puts itself above that, in other words. At the same time, subject means, like when you talk about the subject of a king, it means to be thrown under. The subject, to be a subject of the kingdom, of the king, means to be thrown under the king. To have a position that is under the king. To be subject to the king, subject to the rule of the kingdom. So it has both those meanings. So these words, subject and object, are very dynamic words. We think of subject and object as stationary things, static things. But actually they are dynamic in their original etymological derivative. And from the original etymological analysis, we can find that these words have a dynamic origin, have a dynamic significance which has been lost in the kind of thinking that tries to abstractly conceive of subjects and objects as stationary things, simply one thing here, one thing there, opposed to one another without much of a relationship between each other. But really they have a dynamic relationship with each other. One can't exist without the other. And simply a thing, similarly a thing cannot exist without thinking. For example, what is a fossil? We examine it. As we examine it, we observe color and the hardness of stone. But these qualities are simply thoughts within us. A thinking stage. What is color? A concept within our consciousness. So any kind of existence presupposes a subject or a consciousness. This is the crux of the argument. We discussed this before previously. We discussed this previously also, that a color will, a color of a thing will depend on who is perceiving it. A human being can see, the eye of the human being can see the visible white light spectrum of electromagnetism. The visible white light spectrum of electromagnetism. Electromagnetism spectrum is more than just the visible white light. Visible white light means the seven colors of the rainbow: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. And beyond that range, there is the ultraviolet range and the microwave range, infrared range, so many different frequencies. Color is depending, according to this modern scientific understanding. Color is dependent upon the frequencies. Of course, that understanding can also be challenged. There are many arguments against that idea. But anyhow, then the colors are what we can observe, is what we attribute to the object. But there may be many frequencies coming from that object, not only the white, visible white light colors. There may be many objects. And some animals, some insects, they actually see different ultraviolet colors that we don't see. So what the color of a thing is, that will be depending upon the perceiver or the consciousness, the subject. That will determine what the object is. The color of the object is determined by the consciousness. Similarly, to say that something is hard. Now, to our hand, it may be hard because our hand is soft. To our touch, we may call it hard. But to a dinosaur, to an elephant, the walnut is hard. But to the elephant, is it hard? He doesn't feel it to be very hard. He feels it to be something soft. Okay. So to say that the thing is this color or this hardness or softness, that all depends upon the person doing the observation and attributing those qualities to that which he is perceiving. So the perception of the subject has an essential effect on what it is that is being perceived. And if you change the subject in some way, then the perception will also be changed. And that means the object, well, qualities, the object is based upon its qualities, that will also be changed. So we can't say that the scientists have an objective understanding of the world as it is. In itself and for itself, they don't have the conception. Okay. Now wait. You kindly wait until we finish talking. Then you can ask questions. Okay. So that you don't disturb the train of thought here. A little difficult. I wanted to get some points across, and I'd like you to listen, hear these things, and try to think about them first before asking any questions. Then after that, once you catch these points, then you can ask whatever questions you have. All right. So any kind of existence presupposes a subject or consciousness. This is the crux of the argument. No object can exist without a subject. There's an object. So there is the thinker and the thought. There is a thinker, they must be thinking something, so an object is there. And if there is an object, then whatever attribute it has must be reflected in the consciousness of a subject. Otherwise, no existence is possible. Okay, do you follow? Is that clear to everybody? Does anyone have any question on that?
So, Maharaj, you are saying that both subject and object have a dynamic relationship. So, both the subject and object, the dynamic here in the
dynamic
totality of the
yes.
event. So that means when a particular perception, a particular type of reception is there in a subject, and the object appears, the quality of the object appears to be in accordance with that. So that means the scientists are also actually then in that sense noticing only a very stationary aspect of the dynamic totality.
Yes,
Indra of...
I have a partial conception of the total of the total of the whole. Let's say they have a partial conception of the whole. They have only the outer superficial part. They have recognized. They give recognition only to the outer superficial part of the whole, and they don't understand the inner subjective contribution to the reality, the whole totality of reality. They only understand the superficial outside portion.
They don't understand what matters. They don't understand.
They only understand the superficial outer portion of the reality, and out. An external concept of reality they have, and they think that is the whole, but it is not. It can't be explained. It can't explain the whole. It doesn't explain the whole. It doesn't include the rest of what is going on in the reality that they are experiencing. Well, their total reality is something different than what the scientists say, because they simply directed their attention to the outer, the most outward portion, the surface of the reality. Most superficial portion, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Avadhut Rai Prabhu, you kindly participate in the conversation first, okay? Then we'll get to your questions. Please hold off until you talk about the questions that we're discussing, and these other questions we'll leave till later when we finish discussing. Otherwise, it's very distracting to see your messages coming like this when we're talking about another subject. And I feel like you're not listening to what we're saying. That's not.
I just want to write down my questions, so later you can maybe discuss.
Okay. You can write them in a notepad. You write them down in your notepad, and then when you want, you can paste them to the chat messages. Because I like to know that you're understanding this too, because these are very important points. These are not trivial things. They are very important, essential to our understanding of what is our Krishna consciousness. In a scientific way, how is that to be understood? So we want to introduce the personal side of reality. And this is how we can do this. Srila Maharaj is very expert in presenting the Vaishnava philosophy, ontology, especially. He was especially known for his ontological understanding. So if we can try to understand these things, it'll be a great benefit for our preaching. Then, is it clear now, Purushottam? Then, what is being said?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Maharaj.
Okay. And so, student says yes. It is very clear. I hope that is true for everyone. That is what we are saying. So, Srila Maharaj says these are all Hegel's original conceptions, his contributions to philosophy. He was a very important philosopher. And for a Western thinker, his philosophy was very near to that of Eastern thinkers. In many respects, Hegel's philosophy is very close to Ramanuja's philosophy. Of course, there are many important Western philosophers. Kant's philosophy is very influential. Are you familiar with Kant? Yes. Have you studied Descartes? Yes, somewhat. He said, I think, therefore I am. Srila Maharaj said, he is said to be the father of modern philosophy. That is also an important point. Why is Descartes said to be the father of modern philosophy? Why is Descartes? Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. He said, cogito ergo sum. Now, why is he considered to be the father of modern philosophy? He is said to be the father of modern philosophy. Why? What is so?
Because...
What is modern about I think, therefore I am?
All people are mental, therefore they accept that the mental philosophy of is good. I think therefore I am.
They
don't
like
want
that.
Transcendental philosophy.
Yeah, like that. That's correct to some degree. You see, he started the whole movement of this subjectivity. That before Descartes, the general conception that was that truth had to be revealed through the scriptures or through the priests. The descending process of knowledge was accepted as the proper way of getting to truth. Previously, before Descartes, the whole of civilization was thinking that the senses are imperfect, and therefore whatever we come up with could only be an opinion. It could be something only imperfect. And that the only way to receive perfect knowledge was through a descending process from a perfect source. And that came down through the priests or through the gurus and so forth and so on. So what Descartes did is he said, we doubt whatever, anything that is told to us, we doubt. Unless we can verify it within ourself. Unless it can be verified within my own experience, then whatever is told to me from any authority, whether it be the authority of the church, or the authority of the guru, or the authority of the Bible, whatever is called revealed knowledge, that we can doubt until I have experience of that personally within my own self, then I should doubt all of that. So he told this cogito, I think. It has to be based upon what I think. If I think, then
so
it's
I think
correct,
the whole...
then it's correct. If I think it's correct, then it's correct. If I don't think it's correct, then I have no reason to believe that. This is what he did. He is the chief rascal and for this part, God, exception. He placed all existence, all evidence of existence upon himself. Therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. Everything is based upon the I, upon the ego. Not that is wrong. There's one, that is one point of truth, no doubt, in that. But by putting the whole thing on the I, on the ego, he created the modern philosophy. That whatever I think, this is how I can proceed. And if I don't think that, then we won't proceed. And therefore, he created this whole modern philosophy of whatever I think. Now, that may be I think, or what you think, you also call yourself I. Everyone calls himself I. And therefore, there are so many philosophies that came out, he's based on their I, what I think. And they're all conflicting with one another. What?
Maharaj, you told once, you know, Buddha, Lord Buddha came, and from there, you know, this, you know, but, you know, depending on buddhi, as you know, what you can say, the process started. So maybe he has taken that idea from, you know, the teachings of Lord Buddha.
That's another one, another thing. There, everything came down from the rational plane to the intellectual plane with Lord Buddha. At that point. Everything that was thought, was imagined, was considered real. Whatever we can see in the age of what we call now mythology, whatever thoughts were going through that person were considered to be the reality. When Buddha came, he destroyed all of that. He made all of that mythology. That all became called mythology because he applied everything to the restrictions of intelligence. Intelligence had to verify whatever imaginary statements were made. Whatever was imagined, that had to be subjected to the analysis or the critique of intelligence. That was Lord Buddha's business. Not necessarily the individual's intelligence, but some type of level of intelligence had to be applied to the apparently fantastic tales of the mythological characters, what we now call mythological characters. These things that were received by the purified souls, the thoughts that they mentioned, the different personalities, the activities of the demigods, the activities of the spiritual world, it was all, they were enveloped in a mystical relationship to reality. Previously, before Buddha, there was a mystical relationship to reality, and the whole of the human society was involved in that level, a mystical level of perception and of realization. And with the coming of Lord Buddha, he dragged them down to the intellectual plane. From that mystical level, he dragged them down. No, this must be reasonable. These things must be understood rationally, intellectually. And we must know the cause and effect of things. We can't simply say that this is happening like that and that's happening like this and this person and that person. All those things had to be put into some kind of rational framework, systematic framework, according to Lord Buddha. And his teachings are very much like that, psychological and logical analysis. Before that, those things were not considered very, those things were considered less important and even not applicable. What is mystical, what is going on by its own mystical and achintya powers is above intellect, achintya, that is above the intellect. The mystical realm, the realm. When he came, then this whole mystical realm became called mythical. The mystical was turned into the mythical. It was mere pure imagination, which had no substantiality. The intellectual was more substantial than the mythical. This was his idea. But the mystical is actually the reality, the higher reality. But he did not like that. He did not like the mystical because of various reasons. It was being misused by impure persons, unpurified persons, and therefore it had to be abandoned. By the degradation of the human being, when the quality of their hearts was changed, then that mystical reality that were previously experienced by the pure-hearted became tainted, and it was being misused for various selfish purposes, and Buddha came to check that by applying the check of intelligence. But then later, Descartes, he came to introduce this idea of the I am the determiner of things down to the finite subjectivity of the individual, of the ego. He brought it down further from the more universal plane to this finite plane of the subjective observer, subjective thinker, or the ego.
But as soon as that happened,
then everyone became the expert of what is reality. Everyone became the standard of what is reality by his own eye. And thus, the whole thing became, a khichri, a conglomerate. A conglomerate, conglomeration of different ideas, one opposing the other. And that is the situation today. Everyone is presenting their own philosophy. Everyone is thinking, yes, I am a philosopher. I know what's religion. I know what is philosophy. And they are all giving their I conception of things, as if that were the absolute truth. And who has some higher knowledge about all those things? They want to argue with them. They're simply interested in arguing. And to learn what is it, how the whole historical development of consciousness, the history of consciousness, they know nothing about. And they're going on in their own arrogance and egoism, spouting their philosophies, their ideas, based upon their own egotism, and not listening to anything else, as if there was no higher knowledge than what they have. But who has studied those things? Who has knowledge of those things? If we hear from them, we can learn so many new conceptions of reality, new conceptions of what is what, beyond our received, our so-called educated perspective. All the experiences of our life are based on misconceptions of what we are and of what is what. And we build a whole life around those things. And anyone who tries to challenge that, we think that we have to argue with them. So it's very important to learn, first of all, to go to find out who is that person who we can learn from. Who is that authoritative person who can tell us what is what beyond our misconceptions? We want to search for that. We don't want to remain embroiled in our own misconceptions. This is the first thing a devotee should understand. I am in the midst of misconception. I am in the ocean of ignorance. And to learn what is beyond that ignorant perspective that I have somehow gained through my whole life of mislearning, of miseducation, and to try to understand what is beyond that. That is the life of a devotee. It's based on that. There are many things to learn, many things to understand that we are not aware of. And if we can penetrate through those higher things, we will become free from this ignorance that we think is knowledge. So anyhow, this is a very important thing to understand about Descartes. How the modern philosophical thought was originated. How this became originated, and what is the basis, and what does it consist of? How is it constructed? And what is its defect, therefore?
Maharaj?
Yes?
Maharaj, you know, Hegel, actually, he has, you know, such a nice, wonderful ideas, which are, you know, our, you know, Vaishnava philosophy, that is understanding, and it matches with that. How we get that, you know, understanding, you know, what is the connection, from where he received that?
Hearing. You have to learn.
Hearing.
You have to become a student.
Yes, Maharaj. But he has a teacher, Maharaj, Hegel. Hegel has a teacher.
You become a student of Hegel. I become a student of Hegelian. You become
Maharaj,
a student of a Vaishnava,
Maharaj,
then you will learn these things. How he got that is another thing I don't know. But our position is to learn these things.
Yes,
we're not Hegel. I once wrote to Sridhar Maharaj, I said, I think Hegel is coming from Brahma somehow, has some understanding of Brahman. It must be related to Brahma. Gormaz never replied to that. But that was my realization at that time when I was reading him for the first time. A distinct impression came to me that he had the conception of Brahman, and therefore somehow he was representative of Brahma. And Sridhar Maharaj confirmed, at least, that his conception is very close to the Eastern thinkers. He didn't exactly claim that he was from a descendant of Brahma or connected with Brahma, but he said at least that he was connected, because who can say what his actual position was? Somehow he came and he presented his philosophy. No one really knows how he got that. But anyhow, not all descendants of the higher world, not all who descend from the higher world have to explain themselves. What is their origin? We can understand from their teachings who they are.
Well, I have heard that
what range their teachings reach, that we can understand are coming from that plane. How far their teachings reach into the higher world, we can understand from that plane they are coming. I'm sorry, what did you say, Purushottam?
I have heard that Maharaj, he was quite a devout person in his personal life.
Yes,
and
but he was a Christian. He was a Christian.
Yes.
He was a Lutheran.
But towards the end of the 18th century, when Immanuel Kant was very, very, you know, what to say, becoming dominant philosopher, influential, and then because of this, you know, this so-called intellectual or rational approach which could not accommodate the religious or spiritual, you know, conceptions. So he
actually Kant was of such nature that he created philosophy so that it could not touch religion.
Right.
That it would make his philosophy, he said, was to make room for faith. He said that philosophy only went to a certain degree and that beyond that it could not go. And therefore there was room for faith. His idea was that he wanted to protect faith from philosophy, actually. And he did that by putting a restriction on philosophy. His philosophy is restricted. Right. And it holds the absolute to be beyond the reach of philosophy. And he felt in that way, if he can put the absolute beyond the range of philosophy, then the absolute would be safe from any of the turmoil and twistings of the philosophical thinkers
of that time.
But Hegel was of a different opinion. He said, if we can understand the absolute through philosophy, then what is the use of our having a brain of reason?
Right.
That is also given to us by God, by the absolute, and that it has a purpose to understand God, to know and love God. That is part of the teachings of the Christian religion. to know and love. You can't love what you don't know. So not only faith, but knowledge must also be there. And he wrote one book called Faith and Knowledge. Glauben und Wissen. Faith and Knowledge. In German, Glauben und Wissen. Hegel wrote a book in German, Glauben und Wissen, Faith and Knowledge, which means, and he showed how faith and knowledge are not opposed to one another. They are rather identical. Real faith and real knowledge are not opposed to one another. They are identical with one another. They are two different aspects of the same thing.
Right.
You can have, if you have faith inside, everything has faith. All knowledge is based on faith. Not that faith is something different from knowledge.
So,
it's essential to it.
So when Maharaj, when we say that, again, there are two things, faith and knowledge and their identity. So this is again coming from this the speculative method of Hegel again, that is faith and knowledge have their own position as well as they have their unity.
All right. That is the idea. We have to read that and then we can find out what is he saying. How is that possible? Faith and knowledge have some have much in common with one another.
Yes, ma'am.
Then, so this is important, father of modern philosophy. Why Descartes is the father of modern philosophy? We should try to understand that. If we are interested in presenting these things philosophically, that will be a very essential point to understand how the history of consciousness has been developed over the centuries and why we have such a different conception from the ancients. Why today our conceptions are so different from what we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, for instance. Why did that happen? And we can trace that out through the study of the history from that those olden days to Buddha, to Descartes, to the modern Hegel, and our modern scientific conceptions. The whole thing can be laid out in a comprehensible form, and then we can understand where we are and where we have to go and how we can get there. All those things will become available to us in a clear way. And the clarity of our conception of these things will be the measure of our spiritual development.
Yes.
Anyone can claim sentimentally, oh yes, I am this, I am that. But what is the clarity of their conception? That has to be observed also. That has to be seen. And they'll be in a very good position if the clarity of their conception is there. Then they'll be in a very good position of not being subjected to so many other things, distractions. That will be the measure of our progress. Of course, that is not all. Clarity of our conception is not all. There must be some love. There must be some dedication. There must be some devotion. Otherwise, we will be dragged out from that plane also. Genuine devotion, there is no question that surrender and submission and servile attitude, loving relationship with Krishna has to be there. That means a very clear conception of God and a consciousness of Krishna must be there. And the all-attractive, because what is driving everything is that beauty, love, and sweetness. We will find, and if we do not find the beauty, the love, and the sweetness, and all those things, we will feel it to be a dry thing. We will not have captured the proper essence. But those things have their own beauty, their own charm. They have their own beauty and their own charm, all those things. And that drags us to that plane higher and higher. Without that attraction, we won't be drawn there. It is not merely for having some godless knowledge. The knowledge of God can't be godless. You must be full of the proper attitude, and you won't be able to get that knowledge without the proper attitude of submission and understanding of who God is and who you are and the relationship of submission, humility. You won't be able to get that clarity. And the reality is constructed in that way. And the knowledge is of such nature that unless it conforms to the will of the Lord, to the arrangement of the Lord, then it won't become manifest in that situation. No, then we have to follow what the Bhagavad Gita teaches, what the great acharyas have taught. And that will create the proper atmosphere in which that knowledge can manifest and reveal itself in us. So anyhow, there's the father of modern philosophy. Then there is Berkeley. Berkeley is an extreme subjective thinker. Locke, Hume, Mill, Berkeley, Johnson, Kant, and Hegel, all these are important Western philosophers. I prefer to study Eastern philosophy, says the student. What kind of Eastern philosophy do you study? Sankhya, Yoga, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Zen Buddhism and Taoism, Chinese philosophy. Confucius came from China. Before Buddhism, Confucius was present in China. Then gradually, moving west, we find Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Have you studied them? Yes, I've studied them a little. Sridhar Maharaj. The concept of parallelism forwarded by Plato was also accepted in Vaishnava philosophy to a certain extent. According to Plato, the forms we experience are a reflection of ideal form. This was his understanding of how the forms we perceive are a perverted reflection of the original spiritual world. That is the theory of parallelism of Plato. We discussed this once also. When I said, when you see something and you say, this is a cow, the this which you experience has to be judged as to what it is. That being that is before you, we have to judge what it is, and we say cow. Determine. We say cow. Where does cow come from? Cow is a concept. We apply to the experience. So the concept is required as well as a thing that is being conceived. Both are necessary, otherwise I can't tell what it is. Can you please explain more about parallels between Hegel's philosophy and Krishna consciousness? In Hegel's philosophy, truth progresses through thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The truth moves in a crooked way. In the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, the word vilas means playful movement. Well, you may take it to mean that the absolute is absorbed in play, and that is expressed through crookedness. Ahar eva kati premna fabhava kutila bhavet. A serpent moves in a crooked way. Similarly, the movements of the absolute are not straight but crooked. Vilasa, or the conception of Lila, the divine pastimes of the Lord, is something like that. This is similar to Hegel's opinion, in which the truth develops in a crooked way through thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. There is thesis, then its opposite, and then again they unify and create a new thesis. Then again antithesis, and again a greater harmony in synthesis. I also feel that the thesis, antithesis, synthesis relates to the threefold bending form. That Krishna is described as having threefold bending form. You know, when he stands, his right leg crosses over to his left in the front, and he stands with his foot on his toes, and then coming up to the knee, and then going back to the hip, and then going out to the arm which is holding the flute. Like that. It goes, there's a jagged path that explains the form of the Lord. And thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, although this is not Hegel's terminology, he never used this terminology. This terminology was actually part of Fichte's philosophy. Fichte was a philosopher before Hegel, just previous to Hegel. His name was Fichte, whom Hegel had much respect for. But he felt that Fichte's thesis, antithesis, and synthesis philosophy was too formal. And he developed, and Hegel developed a much more dynamic. Formal means abstract. and Hegel develop a much more concrete and dynamic idea of this movement of the absolute, which is strictly speaking not comprised of this thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, but something higher, something more concrete and not so formal as these three words imply. And yet, the basic crookedness is there in Hegel also. How the absolute moves, how the absolute truth moves itself in developing itself. It starts from itself and goes outward, and then comes back into itself. And then unifies, unites in itself, synthesizes that movement within itself. Not at all explained in Hegel, but in a more complete way and concrete way than we find in Fichte and this idea of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Anyhow, this provides a simple way of speaking about those things, although it is not, strictly speaking, very precise and trying to relate that to what Hegel is teaching. It is too formal, too simplistic. Hegel's thought is much more developed and concrete than we can find in these three terms. In this way, truth is dynamic. It develops and makes progress. Hegel was the deepest thinker among the Western philosophers. Of course, other German scholars like Max Müller were also deep thinkers. In fact, Germany had such great appreciation and fondness for Indian culture that certain ancient books can no longer be found in India, may still be found in Germany. The Germans were never the colonial masters of India, but they were extremely inquisitive to know about the cultural books of India. In spite of the war, many rare ancient Indian books that can no longer be found in India are still safely preserved in Germany. One minute, please. I think now it's 8:30. So let us stop here. Now, can we get to? We can get to some questions. Let's see. One second. Let me see what I can do here. I have too many windows open. All right. Okay, now I wish that we would all put all the questions in one window. Which window are we talking in? I don't know. I have too many windows here. I can't see all the questions. Avadhut Rai Prabhu, you please put all your questions, not personally to me, but general question area. You put all your points in there. This way I'm going to close that window. And we're just going to look at the one in which everyone is connected. All right. Question from Avadhut Rai. Question. If Krishna knows past, present, and future, everything would be predestined. And without freedom, there would be nothing new or surprising because he knows it all. But if he doesn't know the future, who is inspiring new events? If he knows, then he knows the future. Who is inspiring the new events? Okay, 1 minute. I'll be right back.
Maharaj?
Let me answer one question at a time, Prabhu. Can I answer this question first, and then you can ask your question, all right?
No, Maharaj, actually, no. I wanted to tell this same question has been asked by Avadhut Prabhu in his first meeting, and you said that it is omniscience.
All right, let me answer the question again. I don't remember what I said, but something I remember, but let me say what I'm thinking. Then, so far as the future is concerned, it hasn't happened yet. The future has not happened yet. then what is there to know about? The future is not present. It has not. It's not past. It's not present. Then what is there to know about? We say, Krishna, how does Krishna know the future? Future, what is the future? What is there to know about the future? Can anyone tell me? If it doesn't exist, how can we say it, talk about it?
The present becomes the future.
Present has to become the future, but the present is not yet the future. So the future is absent in the present. It is not present. There is nothing there, nothing to know.
But it is said that he is Trikalagya, and even the sages are Trikalagya.
Yeah. Well, he knows what will happen based upon what you're doing now, because everything has its reaction. He knows that if you're acting bad, then you'll get some bad reaction in the future. He knows that if you are not, if you are offending the Vaishnavas, for instance, then he knows you're going to be cast into the deepest regions of hell. Hell, all that. We can say that. Just like I have seen some Vaishnavas, when they were offended, they said, I don't even like to think about what will be the future of that person for their offense. Hmm. So in that way, yes, there are certain laws that are governing the actions and reactions of living entities in this world. And from that, we can determine that what will happen in the future to them. If a child, for instance, likes to play with matches, then we can understand in the future there's going to be some conflagration. Their house will be burned down. So the parents tell the child, don't play with that. This is very dangerous. And they try to break that habit of the child so that the future won't come true. And they can change the future like that. You see? But exactly what the future is, because it hasn't happened, no one can know that. And it's useless to think about knowing the future in that sense. What is the future? It hasn't happened yet. Then what you can know about it? That's my idea. It's foolish to talk about that. Only from what you can predict, from what is happening now, then you can talk about some future events. But exactly what will happen, to know that, we can't say. And so in this way, free will is there. It's not violated by Krishna. He knows everything, whatever has happened now, whatever has happened in the present, whatever has happened in the past. And from what estimating what you're doing now, he can the future will be a certain way, no doubt. But you can change that.
But if he
you
knows
can change
future,
that and he can change
no
that.
No,
but he you can change that and he can change the future because it hasn't happened yet. And that's the way that's the practical understanding, the common sense understanding. It's not so difficult. Why do you want to make it difficult?
I mean, if Krishna knows the future, if Krishna knows the future, that means that there, in his lila there is no surprises. But it is said that Yogamaya always have a surprise for him, and the devotees have a nice surprise. In this way, there is a pastime. So if he knows the future, how he can be surprised?
Well, I just told you. I just explained. The future is not known to him. Not in that way.
But then, if he is inspiring the devotees to have for him a surprise, then
yes.
Who is actually? How is he inspiring?
He can do that. Just like, you don't know what's going to happen in the future, because although you can surmise, what they call surmise, you can make a guess from. What a person is doing now and how you are training them. You are training people. You want to talk to people because you think that in the future they may become misdirected. So you tell them, look, don't go like that. This will happen to you. If you go like that, I can see that this kind of future will result from that. You can change the future, that means. You have control over that. And Krishna does also. Why not? He arranges things in such a way that the future will be in a particular way, in which the devotee can become surprised, in which he can also become surprised to see that this thing works out very nicely.
I think, Maharaj, this whatever misconception is coming, Maharaj, I think it is because of our idea that everything is like static, and we are forgetting the dynamic part of the reality.
Yes. And you know, future is not something that is fixed. It will depend on the present as to what the future will be. Future will be depending on the present. Present has to be in a certain way before the future will be, will come to be out, will work out in its own way. It doesn't work out, the future doesn't work out independent of the present. It's depending on the present and what's going on. Then future will can be determined to a certain degree, just like the scientists. They can predict that the eclipse will occur on a certain day, right? You know the moon position today and the sun position and the earth position, then you can predict in the future, so many years from today, what the you know, what the eclipse will be on a particular day, isn't it? Right? You can say, therefore, they know the future. However, do they know if a comet is going to come from somewhere in the universe and disrupt the whole thing after after 5 years? They don't know that.
And Mark, I think another thing is there.
So depending on the situation of the present, you can say the future will be like that. But you don't have all the conditions of the present specified.
Right. Yes, Maharaj.
Because you don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now, what will be the conditions of the present. To predict that the 10 years ago, if today you try to predict 10 years, what will happen? In 5 years, you don't know the conditions, whether that will change the 10-year prediction or not. It's like that. Surprises are possible. What is your now? What is your next point?
Maharaj, like, there are two things here. One is the dead world, the inert world, world of inert matter, and the world of life, living beings.
Right.
So this Laplacian conception gave this idea that we can predict everything if we know everything at a particular time. But what he didn't consider is the living element of the reality. So, and as soon as we talk about living world, there is a free will. So if we introduce the word free will into this totality of things, then certainly this kind of predictions is meaningless, actually. Will not be actually predestined or something.
I think something like that we have to consider. It's a matter of common sense. People want to say that Krishna knows the future. But what is there to know? If Krishna knows the future, they think, well, everything is determined. But what is there for Krishna to know about the future? It hasn't happened yet. So how we can say he knows the future? In what way? What is that that he knows? Then, by asking that question, we automatically assume predestiny. We are assuming predestiny. And that by asking that question, we already come with the assumption that predestiny is there. Because as if that everything that's going on in the present will create what's going on in the future by a predestined course. And therefore we say, how then if Krishna knows the future just the way we know it in this predestined way, then everything is predestined, therefore there's no free will. So we have already built that into our question before we even ask the question. Then how do you expect the answer to be otherwise? You have already made that assumption. So you have to change your assumption. You have to change your thinking. What are you thinking? Huh? Why are you saying like that? You have already built the denial of the free will into your question, and then you expect it to be justified that there must be free will.